This is a download from the BBC. To find out more and for our terms of use, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/frontrow.
Hello, on this week's Front Row podcast, Martin Amis on his new fiction and the book he didn't write, the verdict on the new TV adaptation of Jane Eyre, and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Ford in conversation with John Wilson. We start with Martin Amis, who's just published a new novel, The House of Meetings, in which an 85-year-old Russian looks back at the time when he and his brother were interned in one of Stalin's slave camps during the 1950s. Mark Lawson reports.
The book's location is a surprise from a writer known for novels about London, such as The Rachel Papers and London Fields, or moving between Britain and America, including Money and Yellow Dog. Complicating the geography, Amis's first Russian novel was written in Uruguay, to where he retreated a few years ago, possibly to put some distance between himself and the British media, which had written gleefully about the writer's dental surgery and divorce. Although Amis has never won the Man Booker Prize, unlike his late father, Sir Kingsley, and there are many British writers who sell more copies, Martin Amis has a higher public profile than those who have claimed the royalties and prizes. Before talking about what his new book is, we started with what it isn't. Last time we talked, he'd insisted that his next novel would be about himself, the most autobiographical novel he'd ever written. But House of Meetings clearly isn't that book.
That's right. I put the autobiographical one aside, the blindingly autobiographical one, and then wrote this and then went back to the autobiographical one. I was having great trouble with that because there's only been one writer, in my view, who's ever been able to write about real life and real people and made it universal, and that's Saul Bellow, who's a character in my novel. And as often happens, and this is advice to other writers, younger writers, is if you have a difficulty, state it in the novel, and then it's no longer a secret, and then you can relax. And then you may even go back and take it out later on. But if you're having a difficulty, state it. And having just written the sentence, real life does not lend itself to fiction, then suddenly it was all right.
So in the autobiographical novel, the characters are called Martin Amis, Kingsley Amis, Saul Bellow, and so on.
No, they all have they all have names that are either their middle name or there's some distance. As Conrad said, there's nothing more sapping of a book's glamour than to name things. I've tried to keep up a little bit of indirection with
so what are you? You're Louis, are you?
Yeah.
Your middle name?
Yeah.
And Kingsley is?
The King.
The King.
Yeah, throughout.
And Saul Bellow becomes?
Chick. Well, that was the nickname he sort of gave himself in his last novel, Ravelstein. It's a variant on Chuck, short for Charles.
And how closely does it follow your real life?
It does and it doesn't. It's a sort of celebrity novel, a highbrow celebrity novel. So it's going to be a terrible mix, and I'm going to be much hated for it, I'm sure. But I think perhaps everyone's got one novel like this in them. And you do think, actually, some of my life has been novelistic. It's felt like a novel, and it's that aspect of it you'll try and bring out. I'll try and bring out.
And we'll talk about the book you've written in a moment, but in this autobiographical novel, does he have his teeth done, move to Uruguay, not win the Booker Prize, any of that?
There's practically no overlap with my memoir experience, so nothing about teeth. And certain things that were prominent in the memoir have been banished in the novel.
The other book, it isn't, before we get to the one it is. When it was first announced, it was going to be a novella, The House of Meetings, and two short stories. One of them, The Last Days of Mohammed Atta, which has been published in The Observer and The New Yorker about one of the 9/11 hijackers. So again, the book has changed shape from then.
Yeah, and there was another story narrated by, as it might be, the double of, one of the doubles of Uday Hussein. The three pieces did have something in common, and I almost thought of calling the original book Terror and Boredom. They are strange bedfellows, but they do go together in some weird way. But then it was anxiety about this Russian novel. But when I came to look at the proofs, I saw that it wasn't a novella. It was a novel. 200 pages is not a novella. I tried to find out what the definition of a novella is, but I think we all feel that once it's gone beyond 120 pages, we're in, and this is 200, so And I thought it doesn't need the protection of those other stories, that in fact it needs a bit of air. I'd had such trouble writing it that I was very surprised to see that it was okay and it could stand by itself.
But at some point, the Muhammad Atta and Uday Hussein stories will appear in another book.
Sure, and they're around, you know, they're in the world, so I don't feel I was suppressing them.
The book you have written has meetings. Many years ago, in an essay, you said every writer has another country, a second country, and perhaps until now we would have assumed yours was America. But surprisingly, it is Russia to some degree now. Cobra the Dread, the book about Stalin, now this. That was a surprise to me, the Russian coming out to such a degree. But what was it to you?
No, I mean, I can see it as being intelligible now, although it wasn't clear at the time. But I think if you look into something, as I did in a sort of amateur historian way, just look into Stalin's life, you absorb that as discursive stuff, like, you know, doing your homework. But then after a couple of years, all that information filters down and passes through some other process that has to do with the unconscious. And you perhaps hope to get a little further in. And I was aware in the Stalin book that I hadn't really done much about the camps, I left that rather thin about life in the camps, and it was that I wanted to write about.
You've often talked about that, and you talk about it in Experience, an exchange you had with your father about language, and your father, Kingsley Amis, saying, why are there never any simple sentences in your books? Why do people never walk across rooms, pour themselves drinks? Quite a few here. I turned in, the narrator says at one point, I walked across the city square. It's a simplicity you haven't done before.
My father said there are too many sentences, like, there are not enough sentences, functional sentences in your book. And I said to him, and there are too many functional ones in yours. But I said at the time that I do believe in modulation, and sometimes you want to keep it simple. A friend of mine said, yeah, but every sentence has got to have something going for it. And I think that's not really true.
Although you used to believe that, didn't you? In your early books, you believed every sentence should do something.
It should have something going for it, but simplicity is something, you know. And you may want to go quiet for a bit before coming to something dramatic.
So in I Turned In, the point is the...
Yeah.
The sheer simplicity of it.
Yeah, laconic, not saying anything more, yeah.
Another decision you had to make is of this narrator who is Russian is the references that he could have. Now, he has references to Dostoevsky and others. He also has T.S. Eliot, he knows, Aesop, he knows, W.H. Auden. That, he has your references, hasn't he, as well?
Well, and you'll see that I do make him into, I mean, I devote quite a lot of space into making him keen on English poetry. And I just sort of always meant it to be like that, and I thought, trusted it. He's an Anglophile in a sort of snobby way. It's funny to have a Russian character praising England as passionately and sincerely as he does.
In some ways, it seems you're one of your less provocative books, which is also not provocative, but there's one paragraph which I think may bring you some trouble. There's a Western phenomenon called the male midlife crisis. Very often it's heralded by divorce. What history might have done to you, you bring about on purpose, separation from woman and child. Don't tell me that such men aren't tasting the ancient flavours of death and defeat. It's quite a bold assertion. I mean, it's comparing adultery as a kind of our generation's alternative to the Holocaust, World War II.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you've ever experience divorce and separation from children, you do feel a kind of atavistic despair. And, you know, normally history does that to you. And there's something recreational one feels about the, for instance, the American midlife crisis, which is what he's referring to, where you can almost design it, you know, with your 18-year-old girlfriend, take up jogging, buy a power boat and a motorcycle. It's almost a consumer choice in America.
And in the autobiographical novel, and this is the last time we'll mention this yet unfinished book, you go into all that, the divorce, the separation, everything.
Not really. No, that's just as I didn't in Experience. It's just ground I won't go to.
Finally, The Last Days of Muhammad Atta, which will appear at some point in book form, the 9/11 book, Uday Hussein, that Nadine Gordimer said once the necessary subject in South Africa was apartheid. Do you feel that is 9/11, the war on terror, it is a necessary subject for writers.
It is for me. Other writers are under no obligation to write about it. I don't think it's a duty, as perhaps apartheid was, because it's so intrinsic to the society. But I would feel slightly frivolous not writing about it. And the autobiographical novel, funnily enough, has an Islamic thread. What you realize looking back on your life is that that you thought Islam came out of nowhere in 2001, but it was always there. And I remembered, you know, thinking about it, I had a girlfriend from Pakistan, I had a girlfriend from Iran. My great friend Ian Hamilton, the poet, converted to Islam, the least Islamic type of human being it's possible to be, in order to marry the Egyptian novelist Adaf Suif. And he went and taught, or she taught, in Riyadh, and I have all memory of Ian's impressions of that. So it, you know, we feel taken by surprise. We felt it on September the 11th, but it was there all along. And that's what I'm going to try and bring out and perhaps exaggerate in my novel.
House of Meetings by Martin Amis is published in hardback this week.
It's over 10 years since Colin Firth seduced millions of female TV viewers as Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. Now another dark, moody, romantic hero is returning to our screens, Mr. Rochester, played by Toby Stevens in a new adaptation of Jane Eyre on BBC One. Charlotte Bronte's classic novel has all the ingredients necessary for a compelling costume drama. Orphaned as a child, Jane Eyre is sent away by her cruel aunt to a prison-like boarding school. She escapes, aged 19, to work as a governess in the home of the brooding and unpredictable Mr. Rochester. The unspoken sexual chemistry between the two is almost immediate, but unknown to Jane, Mr. Rochester has a terrible secret tucked away in the attic. Well, to review that, I'm joined by the novelist A.S. Byatt. Antonio, the BBC reinvented the classic novel adaptation with Bleak House by putting out soap opera style after EastEnders in half-hour episodes. With Jane Eyre, they've returned to a more traditional format, just 4 one-hour episodes. Does it work?
It doesn't work. I think you can do Dickens in short episodes because he wrote in short episodes. He wrote cliffhanging episodes that were printed in magazines. The Bronte novel is inward. It's a first-person narrator thinking about the nature of things. And in many ways, a sort of slowly developing hour-long episode is fine. Nevertheless, certainly after seeing the first episode, I thought, my God, this is running along. This is going far too fast. This is galloping. And I don't know where I am. I've since seen the second episode and the pace has settled down and become sort of much more dramatic, I think.
Yes, I mean, I felt that it raced through her childhood and to the point almost that the characters were reduced to caricature, like the wicked aunt was like a panto dame, the boarding school was like a nasty Hogwarts almost.
Well, of course, they are a bit in the novel. The wicked aunt is too wicked. The boarding school, except that it really existed and the Brontes were at it, is too horrible. The thing I'd really hold against it is that her best friend Helen, who dies, appears so briefly on the screen, simply lying in a bed, that she might as well not be there. I think it's partly been put in for the sake of all those of us who know that Jane as a child is the condition of understanding Jane as a woman. And so they gallop through it as though it was always in her mind. But I don't think that's entirely successful as a beginning. No, it's too fast and too shrill.
Now, the crucial question of casting, do you think Toby Stephen works as Mr. Rochester? Because he didn't for me. I mean, he was a bit too much like Hugh Grant with his sort of, you know, raising eyebrows all the time. I mean, I imagine Mr. Rochester completely different.
I still have my Mr. Rochester, who was squatter and craggier and older and grimmer. But nevertheless, I think Toby Stephen, given that he is Toby Stephen, is doing an extraordinarily good job. He is handsome in the untidy sort of way in which Mr. Rochester is handsome. He has sexual chemistry, which he is not at all sure of, as Rochester was not sure of his. And he's uncertain of himself underneath, as Rochester is, in fact. And Rochester is very interesting because he is every novel reader's idea of a domineering man, totally in charge of everything. And nevertheless, he's every woman's ideal of a man desperately in need of an understanding woman. and very much the prey of circumstances. It's not by accident that the first time she meets him, she picks him up when he's fallen off a horse.
I felt that they got too intimate too quickly. I wanted to have lots more smouldering looks and so on. I mean, he's pressing himself up against her, you know, almost as soon as they've met.
I agree about that, and I think that's to do with trying to get it into four episodes. It's that the relationship is also having to gallop, which in the book it doesn't. On the other hand, it does have the quality which makes it almost unique, I think, in men and women in novels. He talks to her. It's the one thing you don't expect him to do. He talks to her right from the beginning in the novel. He makes little jokes to her. He notices what she thinks, what she says, when she expects him to notice nothing. And he does that very, very early in the novel. He doesn't remain remote and say, "Now you may go, Miss Eyre." Right from the beginning, he's curious about her. He says, "I think you must be a witch." And she, of course, responds to this. Nobody has ever been interested in her. And so, in fact, the chemistry works as friendship first and rapidly turns into something else. And that, again, is unusual. But it is a real friendship, and he does trust her.
Now, the BBC is clearly hoping that this is going to attract younger viewers, and it is, indeed, you know, many a teenage girl's favourite book. I thought the language was almost too contemporary in parts. For instance, at one point, Mr. Rochester says, "Are you depressed, Jane?" Would he have used such a phrase?
Well, this interested me too when I saw it, so I went back to the book and checked it. And at exactly the moment where he says it in the film, he says it in the book. He says, "Jane, I think you may be depressed. Are you depressed?" "No," she says, "I am not depressed." He says, "I think you are. I see a tear in the corner of your eye." "No," she says, "I am not crying." All this is very modern, but it's all in the book, pretty well exactly like that.
I mean, just briefly to finish with it, the first episode starts with this very bizarre dream sequence of a girl walking through a red desert. Wasn't that an odd way to begin?
It is an odd way to begin. I think it's an attempt to do what the book does by talking about her reading Buick's wonderful descriptions of frozen wastes. It's to show the complete intense isolation of the character Jane Eyre. And I think it's a biblical image of some kind of spirit wandering in a spiritual desert, burning.
Antonia Byatt, thank you very much. And Jane Eyre continues on Sundays on BBC One. Now, John Wilson meets a writer who's created an American everyman and stuck with him over two decades.
Frank Bascom is the creation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Ford, who introduced his laconic hero to readers 20 years ago in the book The Sports Writer, with the words, "My name is Frank Bascom, I am a sports writer." The confessional form of that opening line set the tone for a story about a man attempting to chart a course through life in the choppy wake of a failed marriage and a dead son. Ford wrote a sequel, Independence Day, a decade after The Sports Writer, and now, another 10 years on, comes the concluding part of the Frank Bascom trilogy. In Lay of the Land, Frank's success in business, he's a New Jersey estate agent now, is counterbalanced by more domestic turbulence. He's lost another wife to a former husband and has grown up children to deal with. All three books are set during public holidays, Easter, 4th of July, and Thanksgiving, respectively. And in each one, Frank gives an almost moment-by-moment detailed commentary on his life and world over the course of a couple of days. I asked Richard Ford whether, with this sense of intimacy, he'd come to regard Frank Bascom as a friend.
No, I regard him as something I made up and created out of language. He's a contrivance, a piece of artifice that I hope will become your friend. And I don't mean that. I don't mean that either facetiously or sarcastically. I think that's what literature does. I mean, a painter moves back and forth across the room, close to his canvas and away from his canvas, and close to his canvas and away from his canvas. But when it's all finished, first he wants you to kind of see that it's a picture, you know, of the cathedral. And then later on, you can go in and look at the brushstrokes, and you can see where the paint's thick and where the how light is made to seem to appear and things like that. But first, it wants to be a picture. And that's really what I want Frank to be. I want Frank to be, for you who reads it, as much like a character as language can make him. But for me, who makes him, I'm moving back and forth toward the canvas and away from it so many times that it always seems to me to be a piece of artifice.
I mean, it'd be far too pretentious for me to say I regard him as a friend, but I think he's somebody that I would be very happy spending an afternoon with. He's the sort of person that you want to like, and you feel like, having read these books, that you feel like you know. Is he, I mean, there must be aspects of yourself. Is there a sense of, I don't know, catharsis in writing the books?
Well, there might be. But whether or not, and you didn't use the word autobiographical, and I won't put it in your mouth, but there isn't much of me in there other than to say that I'm interested in all this stuff anyway. Mm. I mean, Frank has all kinds of opinions that I give him that are not my opinions. There are lots of ways that he behaves that I think I wouldn't behave. There, you know, there certainly are whole life entanglements that have never been my life entanglements, children, ex-wives. I don't have any of those. So, no, it's pretty much something that I made apart from myself.
So if he is an artifice or a construct then, rather than a friend,
yes,
or somebody who lives within your imagination all the time, do you go back and read, did you have to go back and reread The Sports Writer when you wrote Independence Day? Did you go back and read Independence Day to get a sense of continuity and character?
With this book, I had to go back and read those books to get a sense of continuity. With Independence Day, I didn't. Really, very much. But because so much of his life accumulated fictively, you know, there were divorces. There was a divorce. There were kids growing up, kids going off to college. His ex-wife has another husband, all these things. All those years have to be kept pretty much in order for the book to seem plausible.
Do you have files on him?
Well, my wife helped me a lot to do that. We both looked back through the book. When I started to write The Lay of the Land, I went back through both of those books, and I made a list of things that I thought needed to be kept up to date. Mm. I, of course, when I wrote the book, completely boxed them all up and got them all wrong. But Christina then read the book. She said, oh, no, you've got this wrong. She wouldn't be that old now. She'd be this old now. So she helped me. She means she helped me in a jillion ways, but she certainly helped me do that.
So it's a matter of matching up dates and times. But what about that sense of character development and the aging process? Because he is more or less your age, isn't he? And he bears aspects of your own character, although you wouldn't say it was an autobiographical novel or series of novels.
I don't know what aspects of my character he radiates. Maybe he does.
Interest in sports. Natural Democrat.
Yeah. Okay, both. Guilty. Yeah, got me there.
Same sort of age
as well. Yeah. As regards characters developing, I think that's a sort of convenience of language that we say that characters develop. I think it's a word that we use to give a sense of orderly procession through our lives. I don't know if people really do that. I don't know if cells develop. I don't know if humans develop. I know when I make them up to write those three books with that seemingly same character, I had to go just and reinvent him. And then use language to create a sense of orderliness and create a sense of development. So in those books, anyway, there is no development.
So you haven't been keeping up to date in that 10-year period. I know you've been writing the book for 4 years, but in that 6 years preceding this book, you haven't, in your mind, been mulling over what he might be up to now.
Oh, Christ, no, he's not doing
anything.
So
you just put him away in a box.
Absolutely.
He doesn't exist anymore.
Just like Charlie McCarthy. Edgar Bergen took him, home at the end of the day and put him in his box and... Edgar went on and did what he did. And I don't mean to be cavalier about this because I can't be cavalier about something I've dedicated 25 years of my life, my only life, to doing. But I also want to tell true. I don't want to be romantical about it. I want to tell you the truth that I don't think about it when I don't think about it.
Do you foresee a future for him? It must have been 4 years of writing this book. Can you see yourself setting down another 4 years of your career to map out his later years there?
Absolutely not. No, I'm done.
Oh, really?
I'm done with that book. I'm done with that character. I'm not going to visit that again. I brought it to the point where I feel like I've used it all up in my brain, used it all up in my experience. I'd like to go on and do something else.
Is that partly because it's such an arduous task?
Yes, it's exactly because of that.
How do you write? you're sitting at a word processor or a longhand?
Got one of these little Bic pens, and I have a blank sheet of paper, and I've got all my notes in front of me, and I sit down and I write it out that way, and then I type it up. When it's all together done, I type it up on a word processor, and I print out pages, and I work on the pages.
But what about that conversational tone? Because I think you have that exactly right. Do you read it aloud?
Absolutely.
To get meter and the...
Yeah, and that has its drawbacks, I think. When I read it aloud, which I always do to my wife, we sit across the room from each other, she with the manuscript, me with the manuscript, I read it aloud. It takes a month and a half, all day, every day. I'm reading this aloud so that I can gain dominion over every word, every comma, every phrase, every break. But the reader will be reading it silently. He won't be thinking about the things, or she won't be thinking about the things I'm thinking about, and will be hearing the book in a way different from how I'm hearing it now, even though I'm the guy who wrote it, and this is my voice.
And so, therefore, if it's existing
I know.
In your head, then on the manuscript, and then aloud when you're reading it to your wife, and you've made this decision that this is the last Frank Bascom book, was there a sense of sadness there when you got to the last page?
Absolutely not. because I thought I'd written a great book. There's no sense of sadness if you think you've written a great book. No, no. Oh, it was a sense of.
You're not at all sentimental about this guy.
Or about anything else, actually. No, I'm not. Case closed. And that's right. That's true. And my wife said to me, "Don't you ever think of doing this again?" She said.
Oh, so you're under orders then?
I sort of am. She worked as hard on this book in the last 9 months, probably, as I did. She said to me the other day, she said, "I look back over the last 9 months," and she said, "and I don't really quite know what I did." I said, "Well, sweetheart, you helped me."
She was living with Frank.
Well, she was living with Frank and with me.
Does she ever confuse the two?
Well, not confuse the two, but sometimes I'll say something and she'll say, "Oh, that's right, Frank, go ahead and say that." So she'll kind of taunt me with Frank, but I'm really not Frank. Frank's a much nicer man than I am.
Frank has kids, of course. You've never
that's
had
right.
children.
That's right. Probably that's one of the reasons he's nicer than I am. Kids, I think, have a ameliorating effect on people's lives. I haven't had that experience.
That was a decision not to have kids.
Oh, yeah. We just neither she nor I like kids. I'm sorry. It's just the case. But, you have to like kids to have them around for 18 or 19 years. Mm. And we realized very early when I've known Christina since she was 17, since I was 19.
You were kids.
Yeah. And the first thing we really agreed upon, and I can remember the day we did it. We were driving in the car, and she said something about kids, and I said, "Ugh, kids." She said, "Oh, you don't want to have kids?" I said, "No, please." She said, "Oh, neither do I." So that's like a novel that doesn't get written, right? Kids that you don't want, that you then don't have, that's good, isn't it?
No, I'm sure it is, but there's a great sense of compassion and love from Frank Bascom to his kids and what's happened. What do you do? Do you borrow the experiences of friends, or is that just...
No, I have that compassion.
But without experiencing it as a parent.
You don't have to experience it as a parent. I mean, that's my job, to project experiences plausibly and vividly that I've never had. That's the deal, being a novelist. I mean, everybody has his deal. That's mine.
Richard Ford, whose new book, The Lay of the Land, is published by Bloomsbury, and it's out now.
That's all from this week's Front Row podcast. And don't forget, you can listen again to any programme from the past 7 days at bbc.co.uk/radio4 and just follow the links to Front Row.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including the Radio 4 Choice, a weekly selection from the range of Radio 4 documentaries, and Start the Week, lively discussions chaired by Andrew Marr. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.